You are listening to Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Anarchism is often associated with breaking windows and planting bombs. That's a shame because anarchism is actually a sophisticated set of often pacifist ideas and practices with a long distinguished history. We'll examine that history today using two documentary films recently released on DVD from AK Press. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by the filmmakers Stephen Fischler and Joel Sucher, producers and directors of the films Anarchism in America and Free Voice of Labor, The Jewish Anarchists. But first, I want to play for you some of what Murray Bookchin, the prominent radical thinker who died on July 30th, some of what he says in the film Anarchism in America. Here's Murray Bookchin.
I had entered the Communist Children's Movement, an organization called the Young Pioneers of America, in 1930 in New York City. I was only 9 years of age and had gone through the entire 30s as a Stalinist initially, and then increasingly as someone who was more and more sympathetic to Trotskyism. And by 1939, after having seen Hitler rise to power, the Austrian workers' revolt of 1934, an almost completely forgotten episode in labor history, the Spanish Revolution, by which I mean the so-called Spanish Civil War, I finally became utterly disillusioned with Stalinism and drifted increasingly toward Trotskyism. And by 1945, I finally also became disillusioned with Trotskyism, and I would say now increasingly with Marxism and Leninism. But the essential thing, so far as I'm concerned, as I reflect upon all of this now, is that I had gone through a period of Marxism, which is almost unknown today to many American radicals, a period when Marxism was a workers' movement to a very great extent, and when it was a movement in the streets, in which hundreds of thousands of people at times could be brought out in massive demonstrations throughout the country under red flags, whether it be communist or socialist. And by the end of the Second World War, and particularly by the end of the 1940s, I literally saw this movement disappear, and disappear from history, at least as far as the United States is concerned. And I have no belief whatever that it will come back again. Namely, what I'm saying is, I saw the end of the classical workers' movement. And I had to ask myself, why had this come about? What did this mean? And the conclusion I came to is this, that the workers' movement never really had a revolutionary potential. That the factories, and I had worked in factories for 10 years, and had worked in factories partly as a labor organizer in the old CIO, before it united with the AFL, when it was still in a very militant, you know what I mean, stage of its development. That this workers' movement had never really had the revolutionary potentialities that Marx attributed to it. That in point of fact, the factory, which is supposed to organize the workers in Marx's language, mobilize them and instill in them the class consciousness that is to stem out of a conflict between wage labor and capital, in fact had created habits of mind in the worker that served to regiment the worker, that served in fact to assimilate the worker to the work ethic, to the industrial routine, to hierarchical forms of organization. And that no matter how compellingly Marx had argued that such a movement could have revolutionary consequences, in fact, such a movement could have nothing but a purely adaptive function, an adjunct to the capitalist system itself. And I began to try to explore what were movements and ideologies, if you like, that really were liberatory, that really freed people of this hierarchical sensibility and mentality, of this authoritarian outlook, of this complete assimilation by the work ethic. And I now began to turn very consciously toward anarchist views, because anarchism posed the question not simply of a struggle between classes based upon economic exploitation. Anarchism really was posing a much broader historical question that even goes beyond our industrial civilization. Not just classes, but hierarchy. Hierarchy as it exists in the family. Hierarchy as it exists in the school. Hierarchy as it exists in sexual relationships. Hierarchy as it exists between ethnic groups. not only class divisions based upon economic exploitation. And it was concerned not only with economic exploitation, it was concerned with domination. Domination with, which may not even have any economic meaning at all. The domination of women by men, in which women are not economically exploited. The domination of ordinary people by bureaucrats, in which you may even have a welfare, so-called socialist type of state. Domination as it exists today in China, even when you're supposed to have a classless society. Domination even as it exists in Russia, where you are supposed to have a classless society. You see, so these are the things that I noted in anarchism, and increasingly I came to the conclusion that if we were to avoid, or if we are to avoid, the mistakes that were made over 100 years of proletarian socialism, if we are to really achieve a liberatory movement, not simply in terms of economic questions, but in terms of every aspect of life, we would have to turn to anarchism, because it alone posed the problem not merely of class domination, but hierarchical domination. And it alone posed the question not simply of economic exploitation, but exploitation in every sphere of life. And it was that growing awareness that we had to go beyond classes into hierarchy and beyond exploitation into domination that led me into anarchism and to a commitment to an anarchist outlook.
That's Murray Bookchin, one of many people featured in the film Anarchism in America. That film and the film Free Voice of Labor, The Jewish Anarchists, were recently made available on DVD by AK Press. More about that later. Joining me now by phone are Stephen Fischler and Joel Sucher, the producers and directors of both films. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Stephen, let me start with you. Anarchism in America is based on a road trip you and Joel took in 1980 to investigate anarchism in the U.S. What motivated that trip?
Well, what motivated that trip really was our longstanding interest in anarchism and the history of anarchism. And we had, the year before, completed a film called Free Voice of Labor, The Jewish Anarchists. For this project, we wanted to look have a more contemporary look at anarchism and what anarchist thinkers were writing about and talking about. And we use this device of trying to explore whether there are some similarities or commonalities between what people thought of as American decentralism, independence, and so on, and some of the ideas of anarchism.
And Joel, how did you know whom to visit, whom to approach to interview for this film?
Well, you know, we were sort of at that time connected into the kind of anarchist network, because we came out of NYU Film School, where we were part of an anarchist group, and continued after graduation to maintain an interest in anarchist activism. So we did have a network of people who we were plugged into, and as a result, got into contact with these people, and yeah, they were willing to talk.
And were these films, Joel, partly about breaking down stereotypes of anarchism and anarchists?
Yeah, you know, because, you know, anarchism always has this tinge of, you know, rebellion and, you know, often like violent rebellion and all these kind of stereotypes. And, you know, we graduated at NYU, and we're part of this anarchist network. I don't know, we got to thinking and reading history, and we sort of met a lot of the last of the immigrant anarchists. I mean, the Emma Goldman contemporaries, they were still alive and around. And, you know, the more we would talk with them, discuss the issues, the more we learned that there was a lot more anarchism than just, you know, let's say, the common stereotype, you know, violence.
We played, as you heard, a few minutes of Murray Bookchin, who is prominently featured on one of the two films, which is Anarchism in America. And Stephen, I wondered, since he did pass away on July 30th, and we have actually devoted a whole show a couple weeks ago to Murray Bookchin, what were your impressions of Bookchin?
Well, I think Murray was a great guy, and we've known him for, you know, a good 25 to 30 years. In fact, we interviewed him for the two films about anarchism that we made in the late 70s and early 80s. And in fact, last year we visited him in Vermont and did some more filming with him. I think it was just last fall, as a matter of fact.
And what was he like then?
he was, you know, physically not in great shape, but, you know, once he started talking about anarchism and his ideas, he couldn't stop him. We almost ran out of tape. He was, you know, the ideas really inspired him. He loved to talk about it, and he was really engaged. And in fact, he was, you know, Joe mentioned that we were part of an anarchist sort of student group in the late 60s, early 70s. At that time, Murray had published a booklet called Listen Marxist, which was really a very influential work. I mean, later on, he expanded his ideas into lots of books. But his critique of Marxism was something that I think drove a lot of people, you know, myself included, to think about some of the ideas of anarchism and why they were really relevant and important.
Stephen Fischler and Joel Sucher are co-producers and co-directors of the films Anarchism in America and Free Voice of Labor, The Jewish Anarchists, now out on DVD from AK Press. The two men are also co-founders of Pacific Street Films, and over the last three decades, they've produced, directed, written, and edited over 100 films as independents and for venues as diverse as the United Nations and Saturday Night Live. And Joel, let me ask you about Bookshin and also about the broader question of oral history, which you obviously think is very important. Talk about that and why you think, and perhaps why you might have had the sense while you were making this film, these films, that you were recording a soon-to-be-forgotten history or possibly soon-to-be-forgotten history.
Well, first of all, this is Murray was feisty. That's what I loved about Murray. And he was argumentative. And, you know, within the anarchist movement, you know, I mean, you got as many arguments as you have anarchists, you know, which may be a lot or maybe a few, you know, I don't know. But Murray was always thinking, and, you know, his changing was always thinking, you know. And in the end, Murray kind of eschewed the term anarchism. I think he was more into this kind of concept of communitarianism. But the one thing about him, he was thinking and changing and evolving. And, you know, in terms of the older anarchist movement, I think it was another era. You know, it was kind of the industrial age anarchists, the anarchists who kind of were steeled in the sweatshops and had experienced, you know, the kind of European oppression and the capitalist oppression of another era. So, I mean, we knew right away in the late 70s when we started interviewing these people that they were a dying breed. And in fact, you know, except for one or two, they're pretty much gone. Even the great anarchist historian Paul Avrich passed away, unfortunately. But no, we knew that this was something that would need to be preserved. And, you know, we did a lot of shooting, you know, thanks to the then enlightened National Endowment for the Humanities, which, you know, before Reagan was a little more into funding these kinds of projects, and they put the money into anarchism in America. So we did come out with a treasure trove of this kind of, you know, oral histories, a lot of which would have to remain in a warehouse since they were shot in 16mm. And we haven't had enough money to turn it into videotape to edit. But we're just very happy that we were able to get all of this down, at least for whatever, you know, historical purposes we can put it to use for.
Stephen Fischler, what's your sense of how people felt about their attitude, often expressed in these films, that anarchism on anything other than a small scale is extremely improbable?
Well, I don't know whether the people that we met and filmed would feel that it was improbable, but they did think that change needed to be made from the bottom up, and that it was that education, that reaching people on an individual level was how you change people's thinking. And I think that in spite of you know, all the difficulties, particularly that immigrant generation of anarchists that Joel had mentioned, who we were, you know, very close to, they remained optimistic to the end, and they really felt that eventually, someday, those ideas, the anti-authoritarian ideas that are at the heart of anarchism, would, you know, find a larger audience, and that it's going to be expressed and reappear in every generation, maybe in a different way, but some part of those, that central theme, central idea, will appear.
We're going to hear a lot of from the films. We're going to play edited audio excerpts of the films in a few minutes. But I want to ask both of you, you referred to the anarchism of your early years and how at NYU you became steeped to some degree in anarchist ideas and practice. And I understand you both declared yourselves anarchists in high school while still enrolled in Brooklyn Technical High School. What drew you to anarchism back then?
Well, it was just kind of the confining environment. We went to Brooklyn Technical High School, was at that time, I think, the second largest high school in the country. It was essentially 6,000 boys. I mean, now it's co-ed, but it was run, you know, as if it was kind of a prisoner of war camp. And it was a kind of environment. It was a kind of pressure cooker that either led you into a life of obedience, or for a few of us, a kind of existence of disobedience. In a lot of ways, it was like that Jean Vigo film, I forgot the name of that film, Zero for Conduct. So right then and there, we got to be thinking about authority and the authority of teachers and the authorities of fellow students who were set up in these kind of, you know, these little military squads that patrolled the halls. And then, you know, a few of us started to talk about, well, you know, this idea of anarchism and people believed, you know, they were into the power of the state and the power of the system, that you know, education was a factory and that sort of crushed, you know, your creative spirit. And that sort of led me down that path.
And how about the other filmmaker?
Yes, I think that one of the things that led us to make the films that we made was the fact that our interest in anarchism, and I think that reflected a lot of people who were attracted to the movement in those days during the anti-Vietnam War movement, was really inspired by a sense of anti-authoritarianism. And that provided the momentum and the energy to protest and you know, try to experience a sense of rebelliousness. But, you know, then when you learn more about the movement and you found out that there was a much deeper and richer history and thought than just anti-authoritarianism, you know, that was intriguing. And so we set out to make the two films that we made at that time really, in a sense, kind of mirrored our exploration of the history and significance of the movement. And, in fact, we really did meet kind of sort of the last generation of the 19th century anarchists and revolutionaries. And in the first film we did, Free Voice of Labor, there was reluctance at first to allow us to film because some of the folks involved with that Free Voice of Labor was an anarchist newspaper and a Yiddish newspaper, had been sort of underground, illegal, been in this country illegally for maybe, in some cases, 60 or 70 years. But they did allow us to film on the day that the newspaper closed, and that was really the beginning of our access and really deep relationship with a lot of these folks.
Joel Sucher and Stephen Fischler, producers and directors of two films newly out on DVD from AK Press. One is called Anarchism in America, and the other is called Free Voice of Labor, the Jewish Anarchist. They are co-founders of Pacific Street Films. We have a link to Pacific Street Films as well as to AK Press on our website, againstthegrain.org. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thanks.
The show is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. And for the rest of this hour, we are going to let these two films speak for themselves, so to speak, by airing audio excerpts edited by yours truly. First, let's hear portions of the film Anarchism in America.
Yes, unfortunately.
I think anarchism to most people does mean bomb throwing at first, but they don't know that it's an idea at all, and a whole political philosophy and a moral philosophy.
Are you here at the symposium? Are you an anarchist?
Am I an anarchist? I have studied all kinds of philosophical and political systems. I don't think I'd live up to any of them, but I do believe in personal freedom. And I believe that in order to change anything, you have to change yourself. So I don't know if that's anarchy.
Almost anyone, I suppose, could call himself or herself an anarchist. if he or she believed that society could be managed without the state. And by the state, I don't mean the absence of any institutions, the absence of any form of social organization. The state really refers to a professional apparatus of people who are set aside to manage society, to preempt the control of society from the people. So that would include the military, judges, politicians, representatives who are paid for the express purpose of legislating, and an executive body that is also set aside from society. So anarchists generally believe that whether as groups or individuals, people should directly run society.
In Spain, during the Civil War of 1936, 3 million peasants and workers rallied under the banners of the anarchist organizations, the CNT and the FAI, to fight the fascist uprising in Barcelona. Spanish anarchists organized a whole system of production and distribution, substituting barter for money and shop committees instead of bosses or central committees.
Anarchist militias went to fight at the front, with soldiers free to come and go as they pleased. Collectives established libraries, free schools, and cultural centers, often in former churches and villas of the wealthy. For 3 years, anarchism existed in Spain. It was the culmination of nearly a century of agitation and organization that had created movements throughout Europe, Russia, and Latin America.
But there's also been a tradition of anarchism in the United States. In fact, there's an interesting theory that says the American temperament reflects many of the qualities that anarchism idealizes. Distrust of government, suspicion of authority, and a belief in the plain old do-it-yourself ethic.
Emma Goldman, the famous anarchist leader, has returned to the United States after an exile of 15 years.
I'm delighted to be back in the United States. My hunting ground of 35 years. The country where I had my innings in the social and economic struggle, and where I decided to devote myself to the presentation of anarchism as social philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual of the human race.
Emma Goldman was perhaps the best known of the many immigrant anarchists who had come from countries all over Europe. Italians, Russians, Germans, and Spaniards had been converted to the ideas of anarchism first preached by the Russians Michael Bakunin and Peter Kropotkin.
The immigrant anarchists envisioned a world without leaders, a system of mutual aid made up of interlocking federations and communes. The anarchists hoped their persistent educational efforts would pay off when the working classes would spontaneously rise up and overthrow their oppressors.
Together with other immigrant groups, they led anti-war protests during the First World War and were active in fighting the rising tide of fascism during the 1930s and 40s.
What do you think about Russia, Miss Goldman?
I consider Russia and America the most interesting countries in the world today.
How about Hitler?
I don't know him and don't want to.
What is your opinion of Italy?
Beautiful country minus Mussolini.
Ms. Goldman, should the government here object to your speeches of anarchism, would you change them or leave the country?
I will leave the country rather than deny my ideas. I prefer to stick to my guns.
Ironically, our exploration of anarchism in the United States took us to Cuernavaca, Mexico. Mexico had become the land of exile for many anarchists. Among them, a remarkable couple, Molly Steimer and her lifelong companion, Senya Fleshin. Like Emma Goldman, her friend and comrade, Molly had immigrated to the United States when she was in her early teens.
When I was in Russia and I lived through the pogroms, on the Jews, or when I saw the soldiers going to the war, there was war, Russia, Japan. And I saw the soldiers, the peasants going to war and how the Cossacks treated them as if they were cattle. I thought it was because it is Russian czarism, brutality of the czar. I imagine that in America, the people are better, that the people are finer, they have more sentiment, more understanding of liberty, and would not mistreat one another. But then when I saw the persecution in the United States during the war, first it began when we had the meetings against the war, especially the last meeting where Emma and Sasha were arrested. They treated us all, they went with the sticks as if, well, there was no consideration for the human being whatsoever. Then is when I realized that any government, whether it is Tsarist government or American democracy or any liberal regime, those who have power misuse their power against the weaker individual or the masses, who are not armed and cannot defend themselves. And I wasn't surprised anymore, no matter what they did.
The Russian Revolution of 1917 was a spontaneous uprising of peasants and workers. All across Russia, workers organized factory committees, called Soviets, and popular assemblies in the villages.
Then the Bolsheviks, headed by Lenin, swiftly and ruthlessly imposed one-party rule. They claimed that the success of the revolution depended upon the people's obedience to the single rule of the leaders. The Cheka, the secret police, suppressed all non-Bolshevik factions, including the Russian anarchists. The great anarchist theoretician, Peter Kropotkin, returned from exile hoping to see his ideas of mutual aid put into practice. He died in 1921, disillusioned with the course of the revolution. Ironically, many imprisoned anarchists were permitted to attend his funeral, but it was the death knell for anarchism in Russia, and those lucky enough to escape, like Emma Goldman and Molly Steimer, reluctantly turned their backs on the country of their birth.
Years earlier, Michael Bakunin, one of anarchism's leading proponents, warned that the Marxists, instead of abolishing state power, would simply transfer it from one group to another. His words turned out to be prophetic. He said Marx and his friends will concentrate all the powers of government in strong hands. The red bureaucracy will be the most violent, terrible lie our century has created.